Jeffrey, what's that in your coffee cup?
What do you think it is, Jen? It's Death Wish Coffee. It's the only coffee I drink. Death Wish is the world's strongest coffee, and the world's strongest salesperson needs the world's strongest coffee.
Jeffrey and I drink it, and diehards, you need to be drinking it too. It'll help you wake up and smell the order forms. They have 100% no bullshit money back guarantee, so go get your first bag or first box of K-Cups of the world's strongest coffee at deathwishcoffee.com.
So what does an order form smell like? I went to Temple University on the five-year you don't quite graduate program, which I completed successfully. But I really didn't do anything. I just went to the horse races because I owned a couple of horses. And I went to every basketball game and every Phillies game.
Yeah, but you got a ton of real life experience that
well, I'm in Philly.
Academics you know, don't have.
Philadelphia. Where do we start this? An answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Sell or Die podcast, the global premier personal development and sales podcast on the planet. My name is Jeffrey Gittimer, author of The Little Red Book of Selling and my newest book, The Sales Manifesto.
And I'm Jen Gluckow, author of Sales in a New York Minute. We are interviewing leaders in business, sales, and personal development to give you the strategies it takes to make more sales and make more money.
Strategies that you can take out into the street and turn into money 1 minute after you hear them.
In a manifesto moment?
Well, no, more like in a New York Minute.
Oh, thank you to all the diehards out there supporting us with listens and five-star reviews.
Be a star on Sell or Die. Leave your own review. Come on. Go to your computer right now. Go to iTunes right now and write down, type down, talk down exactly how you feel about this podcast and how it might affect others.
All right. I want you to enjoy today's show. Take notes and tell us what you think on our Sell or Die Hard official Facebook group.
All right, let's get to it. It's time to sell or die.
All right, Tom and Tom, welcome. We're glad you're here.
Yeah.
Glad to be here.
Damn.
Yeah, thank you both.
How hard was it to write the book?
Harder than I would have thought. It took an awful lot of time for me to convince Tom Williams that I was right all the time.
Yeah, that's the hardest part. When you have co-authors, the other guy's always a dick.
Yeah.
And you're always correct.
That's right. Yeah. Or what other anatomical phrase you want to add.
Yeah, so. That's true. But was it easy for you to just get into it and write it, or did it take a lot of back and forth?
Well, let me just throw out a starter, and Tom can add his own worldview. But we started by focusing on blogs, that what we thought and felt and hoped to do was to answer questions that our salespeople that we had in workshops were asking. And ones that maybe books that we'd read hadn't answered fully, and they needed some sort of behavior and some sort of knowledge in order to close the gap on the particular sale that they had.
For example, give us an example of that.
Okay, you know, the standard old one, I guess, is gatekeeping. You know, how do we get past a gatekeeper? Mm-hmm. Well, they need to understand some things about how gatekeepers have changed. They're not it's not a 50-year-old woman, you know, wearing flats and looks like a former nurse. These are in some cases women, in some cases men who have MBAs.
Mm-hmm.
And they are there to manage the process, not just to keep you out of somebody's office. And so there are some things that you need to kind of refresh your thinking on if you're going to be able to effectively converse with these people.
What do you recommend?
Well, I guess one thing you know, I say it's three simple words, and that is ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you went out on the street and you were trying to get somewhere, in almost any city in America, including New York, you could probably say, excuse me, you know, where is the nearest hospital or something? And people would go out of their way. If you do that with someone who's a gatekeeper, you're going to get a lot more interaction and a lot more interest on their part, because there's a whole role that they have that we all have, which is helper. If somebody's in trouble, help them. And so if you ask the right kind of questions, you can draw someone into your world and get feedback on things that you need to get feedback.
Yeah, questions they're also the traffic director in the place, so they're kind of used to helping.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So I want to get more into these 10 deal-killing obstacles and how to overcome them. But first, I'm curious, how did you each get into sales and where did that start from?
I think, Jen, I think I got into sales when I was about 10 years old. And I was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan. And I started with shoveling snow and cutting grass. And, you know, it would be 6 inches of snow on the ground. It'd be 20 degrees outside. And I'd knock on somebody's door and a guy would answer the door and we were in a sweater in a nice warm house. And I'd say, it's 20 degrees outside. I got 6 inches of snow in your driveway and your walkway. For $10, I can clean it for you. Would you like it done? And lo and behold, I would close 95% of those deals, right?
Sounds like it was too cheap.
Yeah, or well, it was during the summer.
Hold on a second. That was in the 30s. So it's worth $100 today.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was back in the 60s and 50s and 60s. And it was $10 was a pretty good deal. And the same thing worked during the summer. And then I got a paper route, you know, and I learned how to ask to, you know, get people to take the paper on a weekly basis or on a Sunday basis. And I learned what days of the week to collect money so I'd get tips.
Hang on a second.
Women will always tip you.
Diehards, I want you to listen to that question that he asked. He closed the deal in one question / statement, told the guy how much they were going to pay, set it up to where, say, dude, it's 20 degrees outside and you're toasty. You don't want to deal with this shit.
Mm-hmm.
But me as a young kid, I can get out there and I'll do all the work.
I'm already outside.
Exactly. Where's your money?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was very well done, by the way.
And Tom, other Tom, what about you?
Well, my background is more academic, at least at first. I got my PhD out of Northwestern University in communication. And so I taught a lot of courses at a couple of different universities on organizational communication, negotiation, decision-making, those kinds of areas. And one day I got a call from a friend at Aramark Corporation. And his question to me was, when do you want to change and when do you want to move to Philadelphia?
Is that Michael Leone? Yeah.
No, but that is, there was a whole different group, at Aramark at that time. And one of the, it kind of came at a time in my life where I'd done enough teaching that it would be nice to actually put in practice and get paid for the kind of things I knew to do. And so I took that and, lo and behold, they gave me every support and every freedom that I wanted to go out there and do what I thought ought to be done, and then got promoted to vice president of major accounts and vice president of sales. And so over the course of time, got acquainted with a number of different companies and found that there are some very, very bright people out there. They may not have academic training in a formal way, but that really know how to sell.
I have no academic training. Well, some. I went to Temple University on the 5-year you don't quite graduate program, which I completed successfully. But I really didn't do anything. I just went to the horse races because I owned a couple of horses. and I went to every basketball game and every Phillies game.
Yeah, but you got a ton of real life experience that
most academics don't have. Philadelphia is a place where you
That's exactly right. I mean, it's not a question of how you got the knowledge; it's the question of what you do with it.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you, it's a little bit discerning in Philly when you come back to where you parked your car and it's not there anymore.
Yeah. That's why you always ask the other guy to drive.
Or Jeffrey, there's six guys standing around and they ask you for $10.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you can get your car back.
Well, I will tell you that we always paid, and this sort of dates the time, when we went to a Phillies game in North Philadelphia, you park your car and you give a kid a dollar to watch it.
Yeah.
Always.
So, okay, so in your book, you talk about obstacles that basically kill deals, right? And I want to know, what are some of the most common barriers that you've seen, besides getting past the gatekeeper
and stupidity,
that you've seen in a sale, and how can our diehards overcome them?
Well, I think one of them is getting by the status quo. You know, it's if you start with like a simple data point that, you know, approximately 23% of all forecasted deals stay with the incumbent. They stay with the status quo. So it's obvious that sellers are having a real difficult time getting by the status quo and getting to somebody who can make a decision.
We already have a supplier, we're not interested kind of thing. Is that
absolutely? Okay. You know, or, you know, what we got is good enough. You know, there's no pain. What we're doing is fine. You know, and so what's happening is one of the things that's happening is that sellers ignore the power that's behind the incumbent. You know, they have to understand that the incumbent often has political support.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a lot of pride often in the internally generated solution that they're or whatever solution they're using.
But Tom, I can save you money. I can save you some money.
They could be internal advocates.
No, I can save you money. I'm a new supplier, and this guy's overcharging you, and you're not getting the right value. I can save you money.
But the opportunity cost to switch is way too high.
Yep.
Oh.
No, I think that saving money is a stupid approach, because all you're doing is saying, I'm willing to cut my price to get this business, and I may not be any better.
Well, you're absolutely right, because what it does is it puts you in a position where you're training your customer to ask for money. And so what you don't want to be doing, you want to, in negotiation, they talk about changing the currency. And what changing the currency means is we're going to go from dollars to maybe speed or frequency of delivery or durability of the product. How many more years will it last, or something like that? And what I think we're always doing, and in some cases not very well, is struggling to find out what that value currency is. How does it connect up with the needs of the buying organization and the specific buyer? And then what is that going to do in terms of our selling process so that we can connect with them in the right way and with the right language?
I would add to that, they want to produce more. They want to make more profit, certainly, and they want to make sure that there's no service issues.
I like that term that you gave, value currency. How would you recommend our diehards determine what it is for their customer?
You can ask what matters to them about either the product or the decision process. How is life going to be better for you? And so
a lot of it comes down to understanding the key performance indicators of how people are measured in their job. You know, people know everybody in a position of authority is measured in some way with key performance indicators, and those are directly tied back to their compensation package. So if you can impact one of those in a positive way, you get their attention pretty quickly.
Is that for a boss to understand, or is that for a salesperson to understand?
I think you have to, as a salesperson, I think, Jeffrey, you have to understand what the key performance indicators are of the people you're selling to.
To me, if I'm a salesperson and I'm on the street, my key performance indicator is, did I make the sale or not?
Yeah, well, absolutely. For you, it is.
Yeah, but he's saying the key performance indicator for the client.
What is your product or service? How is that impacting your customer?
Well, I would not, as a salesperson, go in and brag about it. I would go in with 10 testimonial videos and say, dude, watch this.
I'm Jeremy Fulkerson, and I host the Hidden Stories podcast on the Sell or Die Network. In our podcast, we share stories of seemingly everyday people that are your neighbors, community leaders, entrepreneurs, survivors, mothers, fathers, and friends, but we don't share the regular dinner talk conversations. I believe we all want to be better spouses, friends, parents, and leaders. My hope is by hearing these hidden stories, it will give you the courage to be a better you. Find me on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. There are links in the show notes to subscribe.
I mean, to me, they want proof.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And you're right in terms of showing them something or telling them something, because one of the things that that does is it really makes an emotional connection, somebody that they connect with, or they see themselves in that role, they empathize with. And if you can see somebody winning, then that's a great motivator for you to buy.
Yeah, we advocate testimonials, proof statements, references, you know, white papers, anything that's ROI calculators, anything that's going to give you that proof. But it all comes back to having that stuff impact something that's important to them.
And what about where they enter it on the food chain to be able to get that decision? In other words, am I going to go and ask for somebody who's in plant maintenance, or am I going to go in and ask for the CEO?
Well, I don't think it's as straightforward a question as that. It might be a question of going back and meeting with people at different levels of the organization to get information on who are the stakeholders that are going to be involved in the decision process. One of the things that we've found, and research is pretty consistent on this, is that the number of individuals being brought in by many, many companies to be part of decision process is increasing dramatically. And so, you know, right now we're running around with about 6 stakeholders in every decision process that involves a purchase.
Is it a consensus? Is it a consensus, or just a somebody adding their opinion?
That's a different issue. In some cases, it's a consensus, which obviously, if there are 6 or 8 or 9 or 10 or 20 people,
yeah,
and they're trying to get a consensus, that's very difficult. But it's not just difficult for the seller; it's difficult for the individual who's running the buying process. How are you ever going to get a decision if there is a consensus? You're going to need someone come in and build support behind a position.
Is that a CEO?
No. What you need is a seller that will come into the process and help you build consensus behind something that matters to you. And so...
So the salesperson has a deeper role, correct?
Not only the role of someone who's selling, put that aside entirely. You become an agent of the buyer. You are trying to create change, and you're trying to create the culture around change that would allow it to be the choice of your product or service. If you don't do that, then you're leaving it to the status quo.
So do you offer strategies for the seller to take on that new role?
Absolutely. In fact, the idea is you need to understand what the needs of your buyer are. And are they simply to educate people? I mean, almost always you've got somebody on a committee that isn't as much up to speed as other people are. So the question is, what information needs to be gotten, distributed, shared with people? Who needs to walk who through what so that they can be a contributing part of the decision of the buying group? And so you need to be able to see, does that customer, that buyer? Do they need a change agent? Do they need a consultant? Are there things that they don't even know about their situation that you need to help them acquire the information? We sometimes talk about a discovery process, and salespeople can do a lot for themselves and for their potential customer by running a joint concession discovery process. And when you do that, it enables you to get the customer answers that they don't even have about their own organization. How ready are we for this? How quickly can we change? How supportive are the other individuals that are in the committee or in the organization?
I have a couple questions about that. If I'm the salesperson, what percentage of people are willing to go through that stuff in order to be able to consider this product?
If you look at it in terms of a long process, there aren't that many. But if you look at it in terms of, you know, we need an assessment of who's supporting what, you know, how unhappy are people with the current situation?
Or what happy.
Or happy. And what specific problems or advantages do they say or do they see in keeping what they've already got?
So it's out. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
And so essentially what you're doing is you're asking them, how much information do you need about your own group to move forward rapidly?
It sounds,
Jeffrey, one of the, I would rephrase the question a little bit from how often are sales reps willing to do this to how many sales reps need to change the approach they're doing today?
Yeah, I was talking about the customer. How many customers are willing to go through all of that stuff versus just keeping the person who they've got because they have no issues with them?
I think it comes back to the sales rep's ability to create insight to get a conversation to start with, number one. And then number two, to be able to show the difference between what's the current state and what's the future state look like, and that the future state looks much better than what they're doing today.
I think it's pretty interesting. We were just at Outbound, you know, the seminar in Atlanta with Jeb Blunt, and he advises his followers that when the customer says, I'm not interested in doing that, you say, boy, I was hoping you would answer that way. I was hoping you wouldn't be interested, because some of my best customers start my relationship with them with that exact answer. And the person doesn't know what to do. It's like a new way to approach an old problem.
Right.
It sounds like what you're recommending is that the salesperson take on more than a typical salesperson role and be more of a consultant to the customer. Like, I'm hearing a lot of questions that sound very consultant strategy based, which is not a bad thing. It's just a more extended role than a salesperson is used to doing.
It takes a hell of a lot more training to get them to that point.
Yeah, or another way of looking at it is there are some different personas that the salesperson may need to take hold of in order to be effective. Some people want someone who's more educational, help us understand how we got into this situation, help us understand what the choices are out there and what we ought to be looking at. Mm-hmm. For other people, that's not a big deal at all. They already know that. Some people need a consultant who is going to help us measure the size and the scope and the urgency of the problem that we think we're facing, or how to define the problem that we're facing, because many don't even know that they've got a problem.
But a lot of people are looking for easiest path, especially in today's world, and they may not be as dedicated to their job as you are to helping them make the right decision.
Absolutely.
Especially a purchasing agent who's just looking to save money.
And in some cases, what the purchasing agent is faced with is they don't know what they don't know.
Yeah.
And they understand purchasing, but they may not understand all the environmental issues, the political issues, even that have emerged to make change necessary.
I found with purchasing agents, they don't even know what they do know.
Well, you know, sometimes these are pretty sharp people. And sometimes we make the mistake when we're dealing with purchasing of assuming that they're the enemy, when in reality, these are people that are working really hard, probably have, you know, 8 or 10 contracts that need to be decisions on, and that are trying to move forward as rapidly as they can with a lot of executive level pressure. And so the question becomes, how can I help you? Because again, these are people that need somebody that is a change agent, someone that can get in there and talk to people and get a sense of what they need to have happen. And otherwise, it'll just kind of resolve itself down to money.
Yeah, yeah, I'd rather call myself a trusted advisor than a change agent.
Oh, though. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, Jeffrey, it's interesting when you bring up the point about procurement, because if you stop and think about what procurement's job is, it's to drive down the price of the product, right?
Right.
It's to commoditize you.
For the most part.
Every dollar that they save drives right down to the bottom line, right?
Right, and they look good for it. Some people are even paid by the number of dollars they save.
Correct. But that doesn't mean that it's all doom and gloom. I mean, sellers can look at and ask some key questions to procurement, because procurement has to go and satisfy the needs of their users.
Correct.
That are using a product or service or solution. So, you know, so when you ask a question of procurement, like who gets blamed if the product is purchased on price alone and it fails?
Yeah.
You know, or if you ask the question, who gets blamed if you buy it on price alone, you have an out-of-box failure? You know, or who gets blamed if you buy on price alone and a product is backordered? It's the user that's going to, you know, has the end effect of that situation.
Right. It not only affects the company, it affects morale.
Correct.
And that's a huge piece that purchasing agents or procurement people in general do not understand. Or maybe even care about.
Jeffrey, the real downstream effect is that it ultimately affects customer satisfaction, right? Because it affects whether or not their company is able to deliver the product or service that they're supposed to be delivering on time to that customer. So in terms of customer satisfaction, it declines. Those are the kinds of things that salespeople need to be talking to procurement about, and not just caving on price.
Another fantastic episode of Sell or Die is now in the books.
Let's let the listener be the judge of that.
You can be. Subscribe, rate, and review our show today. In fact, right now.
Or if that sounds too complicated, tell a friend.
Tell both your friends.
Because if you're not selling,
you're dying.
We're leaving.
Au revoir.
Shalom.
This has been a presentation of the Sell or Die Network. For more podcasts that you can take out into the street and turn into money, visit sellordienetwork.com.